Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello.
And Brian Brushwood.
That's a fact. You could take it to the bank and say, this is a fact. And the teller will say, I'm sorry, do you have any business transactions you'd like to make?
And why are you doing all this free or for association wrapping, sir? That's just not acceptable here.
Correct.
Gentlemen, I have a thing that I thought about talking about before, which is there was a talk about, I think it was Steve Martin, I think, was had a conversation. I think it was with Johnny Carson once, and Carson was sort of talking about the idea of like how you develop all these little skills, let's say as an entertainer, little bits of magic, little bits like this. And then when you've got to be doing a bunch of episodes of shows or a bunch of episodes of stuff, how you end up using everything. You end up the little skills, the little thing like that, you end up using it. And that was something Steve Martin, the magic and everything, you end up using everything. That something comes back, some skill, something you acquired early on. Outside of show business, I've seen that. I'll give you an example of something that is I started doing years ago and just developing skills at, and I would not call myself pro level at this at all. I would not put myself on any on the status of somebody who does this on a daily basis. But when I need to, my Photoshop skills are pretty good. My Photoshop skills in a compositional point of view are pretty good. And, you know, things that I've done, you know, I've had stuff like, you know, I've had some of my book covers, other publishers that they've done re-releases, they've used the stuff I've designed because it worked well enough, it was pro level, whatever. And I've had stuff, I've worked on pitches and things like that. And it's been an evolution. It started from when I first started writing magic books and I needed to do images, I started playing around in Photoshop and playing a little bit more and then evolving over time and doing DVD covers and doing the DVDs was really when it came into play and understanding the concept of composition, which is a very basic idea. But if you've never been in that world or the design world, so many things that are obvious to you are totally opaque to an outsider like myself. And after a while, I learned like, oh, that's what I'm doing is I'm doing composition. I'm learning how to blend things, make them fit together. That's why match color does this. That's why this does that. And I'd never sat through like a full Photoshop tutorial until much later on. But years later, I found out those Photoshop skills were great in TV. When I wanted to go pitch a TV show or whatever, I could put together, you know, 12-page booklets with really nice looking artwork. When I started publishing my own books, I could turn around a cover in less time than it would take me to explain to a designer what I needed to do. And so Photoshop was certainly one of these skills that's had a lot of, you know, benefits over time that just keeps coming back and useful to me. And I can think of a few others, but I'd be curious to hear, like, what's that thing, that skill, that thing that you picked up and you said maybe sometime it was just spending a weekend to learn how to do it, but later on it's turned into being, you know, a lifetime asset.
Well, before I delve into my own soul and figure out what it is I did that matches that criteria, I could definitely attest to the fact that that some of the gods of Hollywood have had those exact same experiences. You know, the opening title credit sequence to Lost was created by J.J. Abrams on his own computer using either Softimage, I think, Lightroom or Lightroom
that's
is the
photography.
That's photography. Maybe it was Softimage or 3D Studio Max or something. But basically,
After Effects, you can
actually see some artifacting that is the result of shoddy workmanship. But he knew enough about the mood he wanted to convey that he put it in there. As a matter of fact, we're watching it right now. If you look, you'll be able to see a border that breaks the barrier. And you'll see artifacting. As you see the zoom in on Lost, it's all out of focus. And then at some point, you'll be able to see like some black marks along the O or the S as it gets into focus and there's artifacting on there. Like it's a broken title sequence, but it was exactly what he wanted or close enough to it. And he sent it over and said, hey, can you take a look at this? This is what I want. And then, there you go. And sure enough, they ended up just running with it.
And Abrams is famous for his ability to get things done. You know, you watch, let's say, the first Star Trek movie, and you see the opening scene with the kid or Kirk when he, like, steals the car or whatever. When the kid is like looking up at the cop or whatever, the space cop, whatever that's supposed to be. That was shot on top of a parking garage. You know, they had to grab a shot. They grabbed, you know, grabbed a camera or Larry Fong, whatever. They ran outside. There was like three people there, whatever. They shot that there. When there's scene with like Kirk and Pike in a bar talking, they needed to get some extra shots, but that set was already gone. So they have a viewing theater at his production company at Bad Robot. They just built the bar. They built all that inside of their theater in their production. This is not a studio. This is a, you know, production, post-production house, essentially. They went and they shot that there. And so he's very, very good at improvising on the spot and, or, you know, working with his team to say, how do we get this? How do we get this quickly and do that? So he's, as a filmmaker, writer, a guy who just understands the basics of film mechanics, it's been an asset that's helped him a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Brian, do you have anything that kind of fits into that?
I
can name some skills that I've seen in you guys that I think that it's overlooked. Okay.
Oh, this will be good. Point it out.
So Brian, you've made a lot of your own magic projects. You've made your props, you made your stuff like that. Would that have been, what would Modern Rogue be like if you hadn't done that?
Oh man. Yeah, dude. Modern Rogue has a really weird procedure to show up. It's like there's a lot of very much in the moment. For example, last night we shot a thing on taking styrofoam, mixing it with acetone to create kind of a plastic and use that to shape a knife. It is astonishing when you think with the magician's mind in terms of like, okay, I need to spread a gooey, sticky substance over another thing. What's my best options? And you just look around the room. And that comes out of 10 to 15 years of touring to colleges where every single time, you know, you don't necessarily have this stuff that you expected to have for any one event, but you know that you need some object about waist high to set a thing on so that you can do the fire eating routine. I mean, all of that comes, I guess, yeah, really from instinctually from experience, right?
Yeah, you acquire a bunch of these little skill sets that your production values are fantastic. I speak more highly of you behind your back than in front of you, just so you know.
Oh, good, good.
Your Modern Rogue, all of that's amazing, but a lot of this thing is you're a do-it-yourself guy. You have a certain knowledge set that you do that you wouldn't necessarily call yourself a master carpenter, but you need to build it, you need to do this. And so a lot of the things you've been doing are based upon the fact like, oh, I can build this. If I need to build this, then I'll just go build that. I'll go do that. Need to get this, you need to get that done. And I think that a lot of times it's like you spent the time to learn how to do this and in your idealized version of your future, probably when you learned to build some things for magic, it wasn't like you were thinking like, well, 10 years later, I'm going to want to use this skill in a different way. I'd even think about doing a show that's going to be a lot of cool hacks and tricks and stuff. But also my knowledge of building things or working with tools is going to play a factor in that.
You're 100% correct when you say that it's not the intention going into it. But also, I mean, when you have the pressure of the gig being in 30 minutes and it causes you to pull farther and farther back where it's like, do I care if it's a table? No, I don't care if it's a table. Do I care if it looks nice? No, I don't even care if it, you know, looks nice. Eventually you pull back far enough. You're like, what is it I need this thing to do? You're like, I need it to have the Mr. Happy Pants house at about waist level and something that I can physically move forward at this part of the show. And then all of a sudden, under that new criteria, you look at everything around you differently and you realize that recycling bin over there, my guess is if I pulled the bag out, flipped it upside down, set it by my side, it would now fit this criteria. And then under that new lens, you're able to, you know, pull off and hit everything the way you intended it to.
If I had a dime for every time that I figured out how to create a well-lit place to do podcasts from a hotel room. Like, that was a very, very specialized skill. But certainly in that vein, just the idea of like, okay, well, what do I need to do Night Attack or Weird Things from my iPhone wherever, right?
And sure.
It's like, okay, well, LTE by the window is going to be better and more reliable. Find the ice bucket, you know, you can unplug and move around these lamps or whatever that's going to be at the different angles to light me evenly. And now all of a sudden it looks like, well, people can see my face over the internet as opposed to it just being, you know, some sort of dark hostage video.
Yeah, I think I might have mentioned this at some point in the past, but especially in the early 2000s, back when they were prevalent. But like, you know, there's a big difference between front lighting on stage and down lighting. Down lighting feels like you're in a lecture hall. Front lighting feels like you're watching a theater production. And in the cases where they didn't have front lighting, I would look around and I was like, hey, do you guys have overhead projectors? And you know what I mean? Those things where it's like you could write with a dry erase or wet erase marker.
Yeah,
transparency projector. And so I just would cut out a circle in a piece of poster board, set it on there, and then all of a sudden you turn on two of those and it's two spotlights on you in stage.
Oh,
and
wow.
It feels like an actual production at that point.
That's brilliant. So Justin, I'll point out a couple with you. If you hadn't podcast it, or developed that skill, there probably would have been no Go Game, which you work for.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, Justin, the straight out of J school kind of guy, probably not the you could have done the Go Game, I'm sure, but well,
the thing that kind of picked up at a necessity that really helped me with the Go Game was the lecture tours, you know, and that was something where Andrew was at a point, I forget what really was the spark that kind of lit that, but all of a sudden Mortgage. We had it where we wanted to do lecture tours and figuring out, you know, calling people, setting them up, figuring out where, you know, what the money was for each of them, budgeting out, you know, what the hotel situation would have to be, figuring out what the drives would be in between each and every city, figuring out where we're going to fly in and where we're going to fly out of, if we're going to try to tie a convention or something into it. Like, that was something that hugely benefited me and was a massive asset in terms of getting hired with the Go Game, was that kind of stuff didn't scare me, you know, like I had done it a bunch of times and I'd done it with, you know, a two-man operation. So it wasn't, you know, my money specifically, but it was effectively my money in terms of, you know, budgeting out and estimating what we were going to make in each and every city. So that was huge. And that's something that's continued to go, because I've, you know, it was the reason why I was able to do the In Your House tours for the Jury podcast. It's the reason why I went out to Iowa and New Hampshire to plug The Contender, and those were largely the reasons why I got on BitTorrent. So yeah, no, everything kind of connects, but those lecture tours, really doing that kind of nitty gritty stuff that I had really no background in. I had no background in planning a tour, but you know, that was a huge thing, and it's something that I feel comfortable that if I spun that up into another kind of business, you know, I definitely could do that. There's no reason why I couldn't, especially with the Go Game experience.
It's sometimes things are worth doing just because the experience you're going to pick up doing it that will apply somewhere else. And that's one of the things I love. We've talked about this before. Scott Adams said in his book on how to get things done sort of book, which I always How to Fail at Everything, was he talked about the, you know, skill is sort of, think about, it's not literally true, but think of the idea that skills multiply. If you have one skill here, another skill that relates, that increases. And two skills, three, I'll give you the three most important skills I think somebody can learn outside of some sort of pure technical skill. One is learning how to write and communicate, how to get the idea in your head articulately across on paper or print, to express yourself the way you need to and should express yourself. We all get emails from people like, I don't know what they're saying. They don't know what to ask. It's a very meandering kind of thing because their thoughts are unclear and the email's unclear. Learning how to articulate yourself in a clearly in an email. I'm not talking about grammar, but just clearly what you're trying to communicate, understanding what they'll get, what they won't. That's number one. Learning how to public speak, how to speak in front of a group of people without being nervous or anxious. Learning how to do that is very, very key. And it's not just being willingness to go and speak in front of people, but it's also knowing what not to do. Like, some people have no problem getting in front of people, but they go on stage and the bright lights are there. And then all of a sudden they're like putting their hands in front of their eyes, trying to, like, can you turn down the lights? And it's like, okay, why are you doing that? You don't need to do that. If you need to see your audience, yelling at somebody, the control board's not the way to do it. You step off the stage and walk into the audience. But learning little techniques like that, how to speak just in a room in front of a group of people and present. I have a friend that puts on these startup meetups, and I go to these, you know, just that they're fun to hang out and talk to people. The number of times I talk to some startup founder who's paid several hundred dollars to go pitch in front of a VC or whatever like this, and I ask them to articulate what they do, and they cannot tell me what they do because they just have not thought it through.
Yeah.
It's more often than not. Is there just, oh, it's this thing, you know, we're an e-commerce platform, digital sort of thing, and it's like, you're saying those words because you've heard other people say them and you think it makes you sound cool and like you're doing something, but you're doing, you know, one guy said, yeah, we're a digital platform. You know, like, I'm like, I said, that's everything in the world now. That is everything in the world now. What do you do? And the inability to articulate, it's problematic. So those are two. And the third is networking. And networking, the idea of not networking from the point of view of I'm just going to meet people so I can ask for things, but meeting people to understand what other people's capabilities and what other people's needs are. What are other people's needs? Because that's when you become a very useful node in culture and society. When you're a person that people know, I'm going to call Andrew because he probably knows somebody who can set me up with this. You know, I'm going to go to Andrew because of that. And you knowing who to go to for that. And the more you've reinforced those connections for other people, the stronger you are. It's just like your brain in neurons and memory and network systems. It's absolutely the same thing. The more active you are and participating in other systems, the more you're going to be included, the more you're going to be referred to. And yeah, you do that by providing services for other people by understanding what their needs are. Could be one person A needs a job, person B needs that person's skill set. And if you know those two people and you put them together, you're valuable.
Right. Well, and I think that that's one of the things that gets lost in people's vision for, you know, accelerating their path to success. Like, no matter what it is you do, if you're an independent person, let me ask, if I phrase it this way, do you want to be the MVP of 2017 to all of your peers and colleagues? The answer, everybody would be like, yeah, of course. It's like, well, guess what? The recipe is baked into the name. If you want to be the most valuable player, the most valuable person, then what you need to do is become valuable to other people. And I think it's totally apocryphal, but it's said that somebody asked Einstein, what is the purpose of man? What is the purpose of life? And Einstein allegedly said, well, obviously to serve. And that is exactly the mentality you need to have, is how can I be valuable? How can I be the most valuable person to the most number of people out there? And once you start thinking that way, it's astonishing what you're able to uncover.
I met a gentleman last week who was one of the early hires for Tesla, and his job was hiring. And I geeked out because that is, in an organization, in a growth organization, that's an extremely critical point. Is it's not just how many people you can get in the door, how many qualified people to do, and do you know where to go for this? And that is, you know, I've had, you know, early on, I'd get jobs doing some of the work that I got working for other magicians was because I had a reputation as somebody, ask Andrew this, he will find it. He'll figure out who has it or where to get it or come up with a solution. He won't say, no, it can't be done or whatever. He'll just figure it out. And that's helped me get in the door in a lot of places. And it just comes from, you just say, okay, you know, it's not, oh, I don't know the answer to it. It's like, how would I find the answer to that? And when it comes to networking or people, if you're trying to hire, it's not just, I'm going to look at a bunch of resumes. It's like, how do I qualify this? Why, if I know other people and I know who's at this company or I know who's talented or who's skilled there and I know the questions to ask, then you have an amazing skill set there. So that's, you know, and that ability, like, that's why headhunters and people who work in, you know, human resources at high levels are such important acquisitions, because that is just, it's not a matter of, we'll just wave money. It's, you can get people to show in the door who everything looks right on paper, but are they good? Are they a good fit? And that's hard to know.
Yeah.
But anyhow. Good. Do you want to jump into picks?
I'm just finishing the one thing, which by the way, traveling around, I went up to Canada this week, and one of the random bookstores at the airport happened to have the one thing on display there, and so I guess I didn't realize what a big phenomenon it was, but it's certainly good. It certainly kicked me in the balls in just the right way that we're making a lot of stuff happen.
Did you grab it off the shelf and stomp on it and say, I only listen to you?
Yeah. Like, printed word sucks. Ah! I started shouting. I was like, the printed word sucks. Matthew McConaughey is Hitler. nobody listened.
Justin?
I want to shout out, speaking of networking, somebody that I think all three of us are familiar with and admire. I saw the one-man show of Tyler Wilson.
Dude, tell me about it. Tell me, how good was it?
Doing a show called Lies Wide Open. I think he's doing a couple shows in Reno, where he's living now, and then Houston and Dallas. So if you are in those areas, then go ahead and make your way out there. It was really, really funny. He is exceptionally hilarious. The show is really well put together, and his magic is just top notch. Which, you know, that's really one of the really hard things is in magic, to put together somebody with those kinds of close up chops, and that kind of sense of humor, which there are not a lot of them on the planet, and he is certainly one of them. It was great. You know, I mean, as the three of us have seen a lot of magic shows, you guys probably more so than I have, but in general, if you're not there to kind of look at the finger flicking of a close-up show, it can be a little, here's a problem. Guess what? I solved it. Here's a problem. Guess what? I solved it, in terms of the storytelling of it all. And that is not the case with Tyler. There is a larger story, and it unfolds in interesting and funny ways. And then, of course, it ends with something that is mind blowing in the magic sense. But just great, 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 great stuff. Lies Wide Open, Tyler Wilson. And also go on Twitter at Unreal Tyler Wilson, or Unreal Ty Wilson, and just light him up for not posting his dates on Twitter, which is what I spent most of my Sunday doing when I went to go get lunch with him.
Hmm.
Oh, there was a funny moment, though, real quick, during the show, where my wife, Ashley, determined very early on that there were not a lot of women in the audience, as sometimes happens at magic shows, and was like, oh, there's only three girls here. She's used to be involved in magic on a smaller scale. And she's like, all these girls are going to get called up. Like, when there's only three girls, they will all get called up. Like, and so she's like, there's no way that I'm not called up on stage. And I'm like, okay, well then just do me a favor. When he asks you what your name is, say that your name is Andy, Andy Main. And so she does. And I meet Tyler after the show. And she's like, wait, did you really, like, marry Andrew's sister?
Well, it's not Andrew's sister.
No. which was funny on a million different levels. But, yeah.
That's so amazing. That was funny.
My pick is I've been working on coding projects. I've been sitting here watching through, burning through a lot of different shows. And I found a movie that came out a few years ago, British. I think it was maybe made for TV movie. And it is stars Martin Freeman in it, in one of the roles in there. And it's about a very interesting period of computer history, which was the very early 1980s, late 1970s, but mostly early 80s. And it features a very interesting British personality who most Americans kind of aren't all that aware of. And that is Clive Sinclair.
Hmm.
Who was the creator of, but you've actually heard some of his stuff. You know, he was the inventor of, remember the Timex Sinclair computer?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was, Sinclair was, you know, is a serial entrepreneur, inventor, who created things like one of the first, you know, like digital watches, portable radio sets, TVs, all of that was this very much this sort of, I would call him sort of like a British sort of Steve Jobs, but his business skills were not all that good, and his things tended to fall apart and was sort of a, you know, bit of a problem for that. But he was a very forward thinking guy that did have really interesting ideas and where things were going to go, and, you know, electric cars, all this sort of stuff. So it's sort of like the early ages of the British computing industry, where they made a very good run at getting into personal computing. They had one of Clive's employees came up to him and said, hey, we should make a personal computer. And Clive was like, nah, I'm not into it. So this guy went off and created the company that became Acorn Computers. I don't know if you remember Acorn from back in the day.
Oh, sure.
But that came there. And then Clive came and said, well, we'll get into this. And they came out with their Sinclair computer system, and it went into the fray. And so you had a number of British computer manufacturers getting it. So it's a movie about that period. And it's got a fun 80s soundtrack to it, and it's sort of a neat overall sort of, you know, movie. So it's on Netflix, or excuse me, on YouTube. It's like, look up Microman.
Right. Oh, nice. Awesome.
Yeah,
and Microman. Freeman's awesome.
Yeah. So I thought it was just really just neat. And then you start, you know, Clive Sinclair is just a very neat personality. So very, very fun. So I don't know. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And it's been after.
Yeah, damn right it has.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.